KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny, and what you're hearing are the sounds of Barbara Tuques, a Brazilian body music group and part of the International Body Music Festival. Music you can see, dance you can hear. In the first half hour, it's all about body music as we discuss how the music is made without instruments and hear the music live. In the second half, we talk about, well, the man who designed the Castro Theater and the Paramount Theater and the San Francisco Stock Exchange, San Francisco Art Deco architect Timothy Pfluger. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. And in this first half hour, well, no instruments, no roadies, but music. In fact, it's music that you can see and dance that you can hear. The International Festival of Body Music is in San Francisco, and today some of the musicians are here in our KQED studios to talk about body music with us and to perform live. And let me tell you, before we hear them perform and do what they do so well, who is with us here. Keith Terry is Artistic Director of the first annual International Body Music Festival. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Michael.
Also want to welcome Brian Dyer, who is a bass singer and is part of an organization called Slammin' All Body Band. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
And Dua Barata is director of Sudamani. They're an internationally touring gamelan ensemble. He's here as guest artistic director of the local Balinese group. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Gewa is, in fact, the correct pronunciation, Dewa. We'll talk about ballet music. I heard that incredible monkey thing. I want to talk to you about that monkey chant. Derek McGee is here. He performs Hambone locally, Berkeley bred and Berkeley educated, and well known in the Bay Area. And good to have you with us as well.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you all. And Keith Terry, let's find out why an international body music festival to begin with. I mean, it's becoming big, isn't it?
Well, you know, I've noticed over the last 5 or 6 years that there's just more and more people doing body music. There are more and more YouTube clips up. There are more and more people contacting me from different parts of the world who are practicing both traditional and contemporary work. And it just seemed like it was time to do this. I've been thinking about it for a while, and San Francisco seemed a good place to do the first one.
And you are yourself, in fact, a jazz drummer, but now call yourself a body percussionist, pretty much?
That's right. I still play drums. I've always played drums, but I've been doing body music for 30 years now.
And perform with Bobby McFerrin, we should mention.
Right. When Bobby was living here in the Bay Area, we did a fair amount of duo shows.
Let's talk about the kind of music you do, because I know the sound is rooted in jazz and funk and R&B and world music, but a lot of what you do is hip-hop and reggae and soul, isn't it?
Well, I'm very eclectic in my tastes, so a lot
that
of
that covers a lot of ground.
A lot
right?
of influences yeah. are incorporated, yeah.
And what are we going to hear here, maybe, a little bit of? We're going to hear, I mean, people who go to the festival, a little of everything?
Well, it's quite a variety of practitioners. We have Barbara Tuques, a large group, a 12-member group from São Paulo, Brazil. They're doing their North American debut. They've been touring a lot in Europe. They were playing crowds of 6,000 this summer at various festivals. They've toured a lot in South America, but they've never been here. We have two Inuit throat singers from the Arctic region who are coming to show their style of throat singing, which is really unusual, Michael. It's done traditionally by women who hold each other, face each other, and sing into each other's mouths. So they use each other's mouths as resonators. A really unusual sound.
You give each other mouth-to-mouth if necessary,
yeah,
too.
Well, you know, you always can be prepared there. So
we can hear a little bit of Barbara Tuques. We've got a cut from that, in fact. This is the Brazilian group that was just mentioned.
Mais outra vez apresenta meu baianão.
Keith, what were we hearing there? I mean, in terms of the body, what was being played upon?
Well, this is Barbatuques. They're singing. They're using their foot stamps, a kind of step dancing kind of thing, and then they're clapping and slapping their chests. Yeah, they're just an amazing group. I was in Brazil 3 weeks ago and saw them live for the first time. I was just so knocked out.
Again, Keith Terry is here with us in studio. He's the artistic director of the first annual International Body Music Festival. And speaking of international, Dewa Barada is a Bali practitioner of traditional Balinese Ketchak music. And I said, I saw these tapes on YouTube. They're extraordinary. A number of Balinese with, this goes back to the 3rd century, doing these monkey chants and monkey dances. And a lot of it really is just very spirited, fervid, very syncopated and all. That's the tradition you come out of.
Yeah. Chak was the originally per company a sacred dance. And in the villages, story about people doing chak. So,
give us a little of that sound. Can you do that? Just the sound that you hear.
Chak, 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 chak. So you can use
hundreds of people doing that.
Okay. 150 until 200.
Naked from the waist up and all very moving in similar fashion. And,
yeah. The movement come like from the rice. The movement of the rice, the coconut leaf, so body movement.
It's all about King Rama, right?
Yeah, in the 1930s, the Kregriapo Ramayana story, they put Ramayana story there, the king of monkey, Subali Sugriwa. So from that time, become a very famous monkey chant.
Well, it's something to see. It's on YouTube, in fact. And Dewa Barada performs this with a local Balinese group, Gamelan Sekar Jaya. Have I pronounced that okay?
Yeah, Gamelan Sekar Jaya.
Thank you. We've also got Keith Terry here. We've also got Brian Dyer here. We're going to get all you guys doing some stuff together in a minute, but I wanted to just have everybody know who does what. And Brian is a bass singer with Slammin' All Body Band. And the Slammin' All Body Band has been around for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, Slammin's been around for, about 6 years now? About 6 years.
And tell us what you do.
I am basically the bass singer, so I basically act as a bass player. I also do a lot of percussion sounds and other different sounds and create soundscapes.
You do things called beatboxes?
I do some beatboxing. We do have a beatboxer in our group who he's the number one beatboxer. I just kind of mess around a little bit.
And beatboxing would be defined as what, just for listeners who don't know?
Beatboxing is basically, well, I guess in its rawest form, is basically just playing drums using vocally, using your mouth. That's what beatboxing is, would be.
So what kind of music do you guys do in Slammin'?
A little bit of everything. We do a lot of jazz. We do a lot of R&B, world music. Keith is the artistic director. A lot of improv. We do a lot of different styles. We like to push a cappella music kind of to the envelope there.
Do you do any hand boning? Because we're going to hear from Derek.
I was talking to Derek earlier about that. Back when I was a kid, we kind of mess around. I grew up in West Oakland, and kids were messing around doing hand bone. And I was always into percussion, but I wouldn't consider myself a hand bonist.
Yeah, in fact, Derek's trying for that sound of the card and the bicycle spoke, right? Still trying for that sound.
Yeah, I call that the flippity flap. The flippity flap.
I mean, this is long African American tradition. I mean, hambone goes way back.
Oh, hambone comes out of slavery, and it was part sacred and ritual. African drummers who were not allowed to play the drums, something inside their spirit still felt music. That's probably why they played the drums in the first place. But hambone does come out of, unfortunately, out of slavery. That's right.
It comes out for you of Berkeley, though. I mean, that's where you picked it up pretty much.
It comes through my ancestors from Berkeley. That's right.
You were once an open... You opened up for Sammy Davis Jr.
Sammy, I've had the opportunity to open for Sammy Davis Jr. and great entertainers and local entertainers and just doing what I love doing, which is hambone.
And do it so well. And you've added a lot of finger and mouth popping. You've added a lot of hand jive. You've added a lot of things.
Yes. Yeah, and there's something to be said about body music, internationally. Every culture, connects to that heartbeat. And ham bone is just another representation of that.
Well, it's hands to slap the thighs and the chest muscles, and we're going to hear. Can you maybe do a little of that for us?
Absolutely, absolutely. Here's a little ham bone. Just jump right on in. Little mouth popping. Ham bone, where you been? Around the world and back again. Ham bone, have you heard? Mama's gonna buy you a mockingbird. And so the song goes, and just doing the ham bone and just jamming. And hey, it's just another way of getting my groove on.
Well, maybe we could do a little improv here. Keith, let's... well, actually, let me go to you, and we got a little bit of a sample of what you do. Give us a little more, can you?
Sure. Well, I use the body, but in a kind of a different way. I kind of approach rhythm in a different way, and what I do moves differently than Derek, which is one of the beautiful things about this festival. You get to see everybody's playing the same instrument, but we have so many different interpretations. But I like brushing.
Just hands together.
Lots of different kind of brushing and finger things. And the chest, down to the thighs, down to the butts, and I had my feet. So I put it all together and I could do something like...
Perfect for radio. And very compelling, I must say. Let's get some Balinese stuff from you, Dewa. Can we get a sample, more of a sample of what you do?
Yeah.
In fact, why don't you two work together? Can you do something together?
Yeah, we're gonna work together. I have to say, this is a little bizarre, so out of context, for two people to do it, because it is normally done in large groups. And for the festival, Dewa has directed this, created this piece for 15 people, members from Gamelan Sekarjaya and Gamelan X, two Balinese-based groups in Oakland.
Book, sir, book, sir, book, sir, book. Sirian, Orian, Sirian, Orian, Sirian, Orian, Sirian.
I could just keep going on and on, right? I mean, what are the words you were saying there? What were you communicating?
Chak, chak.
That's the monkey sound, yeah?
And also gecko, from gecko.
Oh, from the geckos, too.
Gecko. Lizards.
But there were words, too. There were Balinese words. What were you saying in the lyrics?
Siririang, or this imitating the gong. Siririri, the big gong.
Oh, so it sounded like a word, but it was actually the sound of the gong.
Yeah.
Ah, okay, got it. Can we hear a little bit of what you do, Brian Dyer?
Sure. Okay. I'll put a little bass in.
And you do work with Keith, so why don't you work with Keith?
Yeah. Keith and I will make up a little something. We'll do a little something here.
Why don't you start it out, B?
Little improv,
yeah?
Start.
All right.
Well, there's real joy in this room. I must say, you got really delight in what you do. It's like Blake says, pure delight. And that sounded a little bit like a digital mix in there, wasn't there? A little
toss in a little hip hop, a little, you know.
Yeah. Actually, let me give the phone number because I know there are many people who would like to ask you about the work you do and maybe even make some sounds themselves if you're so inclined. You can join us now. In fact, this is an interactive program, and wherever you're listening to us or however, we welcome your calls and emails. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Phones are open and available to you. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. It's all about body music this first half hour of our second hour of Forum with Keith Terry, Brian Dyer, Dewa Barada, and Derek McGee. And tell us a little bit more about the festival, Keith, because there are people out there listening and just maybe raring to pay.
Well, it opens today, Tuesday. We're basically running for 6 days, Tuesday through Sunday. On the weekend, we're just kind of camped out at Theater Artaud for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We'll have shows in the evening, which feature a number of these companies and artists who are visiting us. We're doing a family matinee on Sunday afternoon. And then in between all the shows on Saturday and Sunday, we have a number of workshops that are open to the public for people to come to. 3 days, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Before that, we're in Oakland. And we're doing a variety of things, workshops for...
Workshops meaning people can learn how to use their bodies
exactly.
as instruments.
Yeah. And we're doing workshops for kids, for teens, and for adults. We have a body music open mic that's happening tomorrow night, a lecture demonstration at the Oakland Museum, just lots and lots of different activities, a teacher training this evening. But people can check out the entire schedule at crosspulse.com.
And we will, again, go to some calls here in a moment. You can feel free to join us. By the way, feel free to join us if you want to make noises with your or music with your body. Just hold the phone up real close to it. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Before we do that, I want to hear...
That's a little dangerous.
And this is a cut from the Slammin' All Body Band. It's the band we talked about that both Brian and Keith are involved in. Let's just hear a cut from this. Ding. I did hear a female voice there, didn't I?
Oh, yes.
This is kind of a male-dominated genre, or not?
Well, no, not at all. We have two very dynamic women singers in our group. For this particular project, we've added some additional body music musicians. We have 9 people on Slammin' for the festival. So,
Slammin' has been on tour nationally and internationally?
We only nationally. We've not made it outside the country. Oh, well, we went to Canada.
Well, that's
outside the country.
Across the border.
It is across the border, isn't it?
Subhir from Santa Clara. Good morning. Welcome. Join us.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my question, and this is a wonderful show. I had a very simple question. You know, the music that is being made, the body music, is it based off of any rules? Does it follow the traditional notes? Or is it just like, you know, ad hoc, make it as you go kind of a thing? And I'll take my answer offline.
All right. Thank you for that question, Keith Terry. A lot of this is real improvisation, isn't it?
Well, a lot of things that we're doing this morning, yes. But in the festival, you'll be able to see and hear traditional and contemporary work. Like I was talking about the Inuit throat singers, this is a very traditional style. And the hand bone is very traditional. It's very set, a number of patterns of rhythms that can be incorporated. That comes from a long tradition there. But you're also the opportunity to see contemporary work with like Barbatuques. They draw from tradition. They draw from like samba and maracatu, and they apply it to the body. And our Turkish friends who are arriving today, Kekeca from Istanbul, again, they're doing contemporary work with the body music, but they're drawing from traditional Turkish folk music, and they translate that to the body.
So much of this is traditional, although the stomp has kind of moved things along here as far as body music, hasn't it?
They have. I mean, they've achieved a certain commercial success, which has exposed a lot of people to the idea. And I think that's part of the growing interest, has contributed to the growing interest in body music over the last 5 or 6 years.
Are you kind of what we call sui generis, Derek? By that I mean, you know, how many hand bone experts and how many Hambone artists are there out there?
You know, Hambone is a lost art form, but it's translated into what's called step dancing today. And a lot of the black fraternities, fraternities and the sororities, and I know that in this performance this weekend, there are female step dancers performing. So you'll see the evolution of Hambone move into what's called step dancing. It's a little bit easier. It's more upright. But Hambone, you know, slapping the part of your thigh is significant because the African drummers hitting your thigh was replacing the bass drum. And so coming out of a tradition where using the body, but also patting juba, which is another form of Hambone. And there's a place, Juba, Africa, and there's a dance where it's very low to the ground and it's moving your arms almost in the Hambone fashion. So it's making connections that really do go back to Africa.
Well, we've actually got a caller on the line here who wants to find out a little bit more about this. Rhett, good morning. Hi.
Hey, yeah, you know, I was at the summer camp when I was a kid at Camp Rakaila up in Washington. And this kid, he was a black kid, and this guy could do backflips in the air while Hamboning. And I thought it was a cool thing. And for the next 2 months, I drove my parents crazy trying to learn this thing. You know, I'd be slapping my legs. Mom, when's dinner ready? And she's like, will you stop that? I always wonder where it originated from, who was the originator, and I can take my answers offline. I'd like to attend what you guys got going on this week. Could you repeat the website and all that?
Okay, but first to the origins of Hambone. Actually, I think the story is, isn't it, Derek, that slaves had drums and they were taken away from them?
Yeah, the drums were taken away because actually African drummers, warrior drummers, could communicate through the drumming. So white slave masters didn't want drummers to empower themselves and figure out how to break away from slavery, so drums were not allowed to be played. To comment about the person that you saw that would do backflips, doing Hambone at the same time, you know, adding acrobatic skills. And, you know, that particular person was getting his groove on in the way that he could do that. So anyways, yeah, you know, everybody connects to the drum. It's universal.
He wanted it with the website again, Keith Terry, if you could.
Yes, that's CrossPulse, CrossPulse.com.
And we will put that on our website, that is kqed.org, which will help as well. And you say this whole form is almost like genetic memory, when Derek's talking about just body music in general.
Yeah, I think of that a lot. I mean, I feel like there's a certain accessibility to this work, and I think it's about that. You know, it's the basic instrument. Before people were making instruments, they were probably clapping and stomping and grunting. And I just feel like there is something about that genetic memory in us all.
All different cultures, they excel in belly slaps in Indonesia and North Africa, splay fingers wide, and you hear a high popping sound in Spain. It's the palmas clapping like flamenco music and dance. Let's have you all do something together as we go out of here, because we're going to talk about Art Deco and San Francisco buildings in the second half hour. Can we just do something improvisationally?
Sure. Shall I start a groove here?
Yep.
Something a little easy here.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you, Brian Dyer. Thank you, Dewa Barada. Thank you, Derek McGee. And thank you, Keith Terry.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for having us.
And we've got another half hour of Forum coming up. We're going to shift gears. We're going to talk about architecture and Art Deco here in San Francisco. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, we're moving into a different direction the second half hour, the Art Deco legacy in San Francisco, and it owes an immense amount to architect Timothy Pfluger, who gave us such designs as the Castro Theater, the San Francisco Stock Exchange, and the famed Paramount Theater in Oakland. Therese Paletti recently published a grand book with Princeton Architectural Press with photographs by Tom Pava called Art Deco San Francisco, The Architecture of Timothy Pfluger. And she joins us for the second half of our second hour. And welcome. Glad to have you here.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Well, where do we begin? Let's begin with the Pfluger buildings. I mean, people in San Francisco go by these buildings all the time, and they don't even know probably how many buildings owe to Tim Pfluger.
That's kind of one thing that inspired me to write the book, was to try and bring more attention to his work. For example, like 450 Sutter, so many people go to the dentist there, and it's such a busy lobby, and it's so full of people all the time, and you don't always notice the beautiful lobby and the sort of Mayan stepped bronze and aluminum in the lobby foyer and the beautiful detailing of the elevator doors and the Castro Theater. It's a different design. You know, it's more Spanish Baroque, but still when you're watching a movie, it's nice to really take in your surroundings there. And it's a rare single screen theater that's still operating that he designed.
No, we were talking about how eclectic body music is. Boy, his designs were really eclectic too.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, you end up at like the Transbay Terminal, which is, you know, almost leaning towards international style, and it's, you know, very modern. And the iMagnon building on Union Square, which is very, you know, clean marble-faced building. And you know, the interior, though, when it was the iMagnon store, was quite opulent and stunning. If you ever saw it when it was a store in the 60s and 50s and 40s.
Let's talk a little bit about, I want to get into the history of his work, but also a little bit about him. Working class kid out of the Mission District, German immigrant parents, and actually only, what, a high school education?
Yes, and I actually can't even find any graduation certificates, but his brother, in a family memoir, he wrote that Timothy went to evening school, and so it was much more difficult to find any kind of graduation, you know, from the evening schools. But he also went to the San Francisco Architecture Club, and that's how he got a lot of his grounding. He was an office boy draftsman right after the quake, and so he was working during the day. At age 13, he started working. And then he started working in the club, attending classes. And a lot of young aspiring architects who couldn't afford to go to college, or they couldn't afford to go to the École des Beaux-Arts, that's really where the crème de la crème of architecture aspirants, really, that's where they study. Like Julian Morgan went there, Bernard Maybeck went there. And that's where you really went to school back then. And he couldn't go there, and he didn't know French. And I mean, it's a whole rigmarole to even get into the École. And so he studied in this little club with a lot of, George Weeks studied there. A lot of local, aspiring architects went there. And they had little, it was very similar to the École. They studied with a patron, and like Arthur Brown and George Kellam, some local architects, would like host little classes, and they gave a lot of training. And they had, classes in structural steel design and just drawing and just all kinds of things. And he went to the club for many years and got a really good grounding in that.
Boy, when you talk about the history of his work, though, I mean, he began, right about his association with these brothers named Nasser. And here's the Alhambra Theater, which many old-time San Franciscans certainly remember, with Moorish and kind of Islamic look to it, very unusual in its time. And then we kind of trace, you move him along to the skyscrapers next. I mean, you know, to go from theaters to skyscrapers, and he designed schools, he designed so many, like you said, the office building on Sutter, so many things that it's really kind of, where do you get the Art Deco notions from?
There was this big exposition in 1925 in Paris, and that sort of brought this kind of more modern-leaning design to the forefront. Sort of, that's where a lot of people first started seeing these kind of geometrical forms. But he and his office, he had another architect in his office as a draftsman named Michael Goodman, and they were kind of starting to lean toward a more modern look after they got this commission for the telephone building. And that was a huge, huge commission for a real young architectural firm, to design a skyscraper in the 20s. And this was the biggest skyscraper in San Francisco. It was finished in 1925, and it just towered over the city. And so that building really...
So Pacific Telephone and Telegraph Building. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And that commission really, they were really trying to be modern. I mean, for the the telephone company in that time, I think they were kind of like Google. I mean, everyone was starting to, you know, get telephones at home. You know, it was like getting the early days of the internet. And it was just a huge boom and in business, and they really wanted to advertise their what they did. And so the telephone building has a lot of imagery of the telephone, which is sort of an early embrace of the machine age, you know, the industry icons that kind of come later in the 30s. So it was kind of an early look into technology. And I think that kind of started the firm looking to a more modern leaning. And when you look at the drawings that they did, they had a whole batch of different, you know, they're at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art. They have all these different images they were, you know, trying renderings. And there were a few, they were kind of imitating international style glass. And, you know, there were some Beaux-Arts, but that was kind of the first real embrace of.
But you say the influence there was the Paris exposition?
That
was some Asian influence too, wasn't it?
Yes. No, the exposition was sort of that kind of brought this sort of design to the forefront in the world, but they were kind of doing it a little bit beforehand because they started working on the phone building in 24. And the expo kind of brought this sort of more modern leaning design, but with traces of, they were sort of looking to new inspirations beyond Europe. They were looking to the Aztecs and to the to Asia. Fleurer was one of the earlier architects to look to Asia because they were really trying to avoid the European and neoclassic, you know, Rome and Greek references that were constantly cropping.
They wanted
up.
To be more exotic, probably.
Exactly.
Don't you think?
Yeah. Exactly.
And in fact, by the time he was doing the stock exchange, he was working with Diego Rivera, no less.
Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Talk about that relationship. I mean, because it's important in his career.
Yes, definitely. What happened was Pfluger really wanted to add some art to the exchange, and he was working with Michael Goodman again. And so Michael Goodman, Pfluger, as you know, you've known by now, he did not have a college education, so he didn't really know too much about art. But he had very good instincts and very good intuition about art. And so Michael Goodman told him about Diego Rivera, and at the same time, Pfluger was being asked to be on the board of the San Francisco Art Association, which is now the Art Institute. That's where the Art Institute is. So they made a connection, and Goodman showed Pfluger some of Rivera's work, and Pfluger said, okay, let's hire him. And so he managed to get Diego to come to San Francisco to do a mural. And the stock exchange was fine with it because it was, you know, it was in their club room where the traders went after the day was over. It was upstairs in the 10th, between the 10th and the 11th floor was an internal staircase. And so he painted, it was called An Allegory of California, and it's still there. It's a beautiful mural. It's worth seeing. And, but a lot of the local artist community were in an uproar. They couldn't believe that, number one, a communist was being hired to paint a capitalist wall. And then number two, that they were being completely excluded from the project. So
fact that Diego Rivera came from across the border also contributed to some of that, I'm sure, asperity and enmity. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So then Pfluger decided to just hire some more artists, and he ended up hiring about like 8 or 9 artists in total. And so the interiors of the Stock Exchange Luncheon Club, now known as City Club, have a lot of beautiful bas-reliefs and carved wood and fireplace mantles with stonework and staircase railings and beautifully beautifully designed elevator doors. And he hired Ralph Stackpole as well. And Stackpole was another connection to Rivera because Stackpole had studied with Rivera both in Mexico and in France.
And what was his relationship with Ansel Adams?
He hired Ansel Adams to photograph one of his cocktail lounges, the patent leather lounge, which was in the St. Francis. And they kind of became chummy. I don't know how friendly, but I have this great photo of Pfluger and Ansel Adams and Diego Rivera, and then Pfluger's dressed as Diego Rivera after the Treasure Island Expo in 1940.
It's also a great photo of Pfluger with Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, too, in
yes.
your book.
Yeah, that was a fun one to find.
His masterpiece was the Paramount in Oakland, though, huh? I mean, yes. Generally regarded.
Yes. And I also think the 450 Sutter, in terms of skyscraper design, that was a pretty innovative one, too. But yeah, the Paramount is definitely seen as a real deco masterpiece.
Let me open the phone lines. I know there are many of you who are interested in this Art Deco and the work of Timothy Pfluger. We're talking about it with the author of a new book, Therese Paletti, who's here with us in studio. And you are certainly welcome to join us. Lots of local history here and fascinating stuff in terms of just the buildings you see all around you. Because we're talking about someone who actually designed... Well, was involved in the design of the Bay Bridge, for one thing, but also about 25 houses throughout San Francisco and schools throughout San Francisco, some of the biggest schools in San Francisco, Top of the Mark.
Union Square Garage.
The phone lines are open and available to you. It's toll-free. It's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your phone calls, and your contribution to this discussion is welcome. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can send an email as well, and the email address is simply forum@kqed.org. And I should mention also that Therese Paletti will be at Mechanics Institute tomorrow night at 6 p.m. And we'll be talking Saturday about Art Deco and Modernism at the show. Where's that going to be, by the way?
It's at the Gift Center. It's called Art Deco and Modernism. It's a show at the Gift Center.
And the connection with Pfluger?
They're letting me sell my book and talk to people there, and they have a lot of deco design items, so you can kind of see, you know, people are selling different furniture and clothing and little figurines and all kinds of deco motifs, so you can see what the design looked like from the 20s all the way to the 30s and how it evolved.
As much as he's identified with Art Deco, though, again, there's a real eclecticism and range to this man's work.
Oh, definitely, definitely, because you can see in his homes, I have a book... I mean, I have a photo in the book of one of his houses out in Seacliff, and it's a lot of the homes they designed, the customers really wanted, you know, a Spanish Mediterranean revival, and there's the really gorgeous house out on Seacliff that is in that style, and yet there's another house up on Mount Davidson that is a more streamlined, modern-type house that's very little ornament, and there is a beautiful statue that we can't figure out who designed it, but it may be Stackpole.
There's also, we should mention the El Rey out on Ocean Avenue, which is now, what, the Voice of Pentecostal?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Church. And so, I mean, just so much of his influence throughout the city of San Francisco is amazing. But let's find out what our listeners have to say. Michael, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is, hi, Therese. It's Michael Crow.
Oh, hi, Michael. How are you?
Fine. And I was calling to let you know that I started the Art Deco Society of California 25 years ago, and we give walking tours of historic Art Deco architecture, and we start out in front of 450 Sutter. So there are quite a number of people who have been educated about Timothy Pfluger and his influence here in San Francisco and the Bay Area, because Paramount is featured on our Art Deco walking tour in Oakland.
You're not the Michael Crow who used to be a contractor, are you?
No, I'm an architectural historian, used to work for the National Park Service. Okay. But I've written the two books on architecture and 9 walking tours of Art Deco buildings in San Francisco. So there are people out there who get the information and know the influence that Pfluger had. It was really incredible. I also want to comment on Therese's book. It's absolutely magnificent, wonderful illustrations, and a delightful read. You've got a wonderful style.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. The photographer you worked with, you want to give him credit?
Oh, Tom Pava, yes. He's an excellent photographer, and he did the work really for hardly any money at all. I got grants to pay for my photography because I did this book basically in my spare time. And Tom is a professional photographer in L.A., and he does a lot of architecture work, and he also does a lot of work in night vision photography, mm-hmm. and I connected with him through my publisher in Plant Construction, and he was an awesome gem to work with.
And Harold, join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Barely, but go ahead. Speak up.
I just wanted to point out that Pfluger designed the Alameda Theater, and it was recently refurbished last year, or at the beginning of this year, and it's just amazing. People should try to stop by and take a look at it.
Yes, the Alameda is in my book, and unfortunately it was under construction when I was doing my photography, but I have a really good drawing of it, and I thank you for mentioning it because it's an awesome theater.
Yeah, thank you, Harold. Are any of the other of his buildings in disrepair and in need of renovation that we know of?
Well, the Transit Terminal is slated to be demolished. The Tulare Theater in Tulare, California was demolished, and that was a really interesting one. It was sort of like the gates of Ishtar, the Ishtar Gate. That was kind of the model. And he's got a couple of theaters, one in Oroville, they've been rehabbing it, and in Chico, that one's been rehabbed. And those are being used as performing art space, which is great. And the Pyramid, I think, can be cited as doing one of the major restoration jobs.
You mentioned that his origins begin really after the quake, and you go into the whole history, the personal history, and his history as an architect and so forth. But shoot forward to 1939. The World's Fair was here in San Francisco, and he was involved.
Yes, he was a consulting architect. There were, I think, a board of five or six architects, and they all did a lot of different buildings, and the style of the fair was sort of, it was competing with New York, and the New York World's Fair was the fair, it was the land of tomorrow, very futuristic. You know, Norman Bel Geddes was doing stuff. It was just more moving forward.
And great novel about it by E.L. Doctorow, in fact.
Yeah. Oh, yes, exactly. And so the San Francisco Fair was kind of looking to the past a little bit, and Pfluger and William Worster designed the most modern buildings at the fair. And in addition to that, they had Diego Rivera come again to do artwork. And he did a beautiful mural while at the fair. They had this exhibit in the Arts Pavilion called Art in Action. And so Diego and a lot of other artists worked in this little pavilion to draw people to watch people at work. And then the mural is now at City College. And it's called the Diego Rivera Theater. And it's eight panels, and it's a massive, beautiful mural that was designed at the fair. And it was also in storage for many, many years after the fair, and then they found it later.
And if you've just joined us, we're talking with Therese Paletti, journalist and author of Art Deco San Francisco, The Architecture of Timothy Pfluger. And you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email forum@kqed.org. And here's Catherine, who writes in the following email: the 450 Sutter Medical Building designed by Timothy Pfluger is, for my family, as for many San Francisco families, part of our history. It was at an office at 450 Sutter that my husband and I first heard our daughter's heartbeat when she was still in utero, and now I take that daughter to her orthodontic appointments at 450 Sutter. The building's glorious style reminds us how fortunate we are to go about our daily lives in splendid San Francisco. It's that Mayan look that gets you every time. Wait, do you have a favorite Pfluger building?
I would say I like the Paramount, 450, and I love George Washington High School. That's one of my favorite high schools. It's such an interesting example of this sort of, you know, streamlined look, but yet it has this neoclassical elements with these kind of modern columns that are sort of a reference to George Washington's home at Mount Vernon. And then it has so much artwork. There's murals all over. And it needs a little work, you know, in paint and such, but it's a really beautiful, and it takes advantage of its beautiful site. It was a former rock quarry, and
I should mention it's on 32nd Avenue.
Oh, yes, it's out in the avenues, and you can see the Golden Gate Bridge and the whole bay. It's just a beautiful school.
Casey, join us. You're on forum.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a question about the old American Theater on Fillmore. I bought the contents of it when they were demolishing the Fillmore District, and it was completely Art Deco on the inside, but I think it was an older theater that had been redone in blue glass mirror and some really fabulous Art Deco rugs and curtains and things. But do you know about the American Theater?
No, it was not the new Fillmore, right? It was called the New American?
It might have been New American, yeah.
Okay, because
it was on Fillmore.
It was on Fillmore. Because Pfluger did a remodel of I believe it was a Reed Brothers theater that was on Fillmore called it was called the New Fillmore. And that was sort of a Beaux-Arts
this
theater.
This wasn't on the corner. This wasn't the Fillmore theater that we think of. It was a block or two down Fillmore.
Okay.
But it was called the American Theater, I believe. I don't remember the term new. Maybe another caller can clarify that. But it seemed like an older theater, but it had been completely done in Art Deco interior. wise.
Hmm. You know, Jack Tilmany has a really good book called Theaters of San Francisco. You might want to check that out. It's an Arcadia book, and he probably mentions it in there. It doesn't quite come to mind, but that's a possibility for you to find more information on it.
Well, Pfluger is identified with theaters, no question about it. And also, as thanks to that caller, as she suggested, a lot of these metal and concrete and glass designs really began in San Francisco with Pfluger.
Yes, yes, I think, and I also think that he influenced a lot of the ensuing skyscrapers in the 20s. The George Kellam Shell Building is clearly influenced, and as is the Russ Building. And then there was another building that was demolished, the Pacific National Bank, that also got its inspiration from the Telephone Building.
But he was given a good deal of his due in his day, and I mean, sounds like, you know, now memory lapses and things retreat and he doesn't get the recognition he deserves. But I mean, even I remember Alan Temko writing about, you know, what a genius Pfluger was, that sort of thing.
Yes. Oh, definitely when he was around and in his era, I think he really got his kudos. He was really well known. And at the same time, he was sort of blended in with people. The few people that I found that knew him said, you know, everybody knew Tim Pfluger, and he had this sort of...
He belonged to both the Bohemian Club and the family, right?
Yes.
Which is pretty unusual.
And the Olympic Club.
And the Olympic Club, that's right.
Yeah.
Let's hear from Scott. Scott, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just curious if there was any interconnection between Pfluger and A.G. Rizzulli. I saw that show on Rizzulli at the Museum of Modern Art, and I've just been fascinated with him ever since.
Too bad we don't have the hour we did on Rizzulli in our archives. It goes back too far. But what are there connections there?
I don't know, actually. But that would be interesting to look into.
Well, I ask because they were both involved in the architectural club. That's where Rizzulli got
right.
most of his later training.
Right. Do you know what year he was at the architectural club?
I was too lazy to race to the book and look it up, but I just thought maybe you had some idea.
It's possible they were there at the same time. I think Pfluger was there until the early 20s.
Yeah, so they probably overlapped. But
get off your duff and use the search engine, Scott. Then you
yeah,
can find
exactly.
It.
Okay, well, thank you.
No, thanks for the
call.
Those
are hard things to find in search engines.
Yeah, actually, you're right. They are. Here's Alan, who says, FYI, Pfluger's Pacific Telephone Building on Montgomery Street is now being refitted as residential condominium, so people can now live in a true gem, from a listener named Alan. Here's Dan, who says, I've been living at the intersection of Market and Octavia for 11 years now. There are several buildings in the neighborhood that are considered Art Deco. However, I have also humorously heard the neighborhood coined as the Deco Ghetto. Any thoughts or insights of that neighborhood, specifically lining Market Street between Guerrero and, say, Gough Street?
I think it got the name from some of the little Art Deco furniture stores that were right around there. And then there's also that really beautiful apartment building with the laundry in at the street front. And I don't know who designed that building, but yeah, there's definitely a lot of deco right in that area.
Yeah, getting back to what was his involvement exactly in the Bay Bridge?
He was the chief architect. There were three consulting architects, and he was the chairman of the... And it was interesting because they didn't have as much influence on the Bay Bridge as they would have liked. They were constantly feuding with the engineers. The engineers didn't want any ornament. And you know, they basically their main influence was they on the suspension tower design. The engineers wanted to add some struts in between some of the bars, and the architects basically redesigned the suspension tower so they look longer and more elegant. And Pfluger also wanted Stackpole to design a big sculpture for the as a center anchorage, and it was sort of an Egyptian figure holding cables, and that was very, you know, modern looking piece. But the engineers poo-pooed that. They said, no way, we're not going to do this. So it was interesting reading the memos between the architects and the engineers. They were constantly battling because the engineers really had to stay to their budget.
It's very contentious, yeah. We'll get Paul on next from Livermore. Hi, Paul.
Thanks, Michael. Say, on the corner of Bush and Dashiell Hammett is where Masa's restaurant is. And if you go up to the 8th floor, it's the business office. And there's this beautiful oval arched stained glass window. I was wondering if you know anything about that.
No, it's in the building that Masa's is in?
Yeah. Yeah, you go up to the 8th floor, and that's where I had to go get checks, basically. But man, oh man, it's you know, it's like 20 by 20 almost.
No, oh, interesting. I'll have to go check that out. No, I know that because it's right across from Chelsea Place, correct? The little alley, Chelsea Place.
Well, Dashiell Hammett comes straight down the hill.
And Dashiell Hammett Alley's right on that block.
Right, right.
No, I'm sorry. I don't know that.
Yeah, you should go look at it. It's a beautiful work of art. I don't know who did it, but.
Well, I'm glad you brought it to our attention, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you.
What about lighting designs? That was something that he was very innovative and pioneering.
Yes, he got a patent for a ceiling, like a metal filigree ceiling design, and it was used in the Paramount Theater and in the Stock Exchange and also in the El Rey Theater. It was sort of like a metal filigree, and it would sort of hide the light fixtures, and it also kind of had an acoustical benefit. It added, you know, some ripples so that the sound waves would move all around the room. And that was one thing that the Paramount has, is just it's completely covered with artwork. And so it's really good acoustically for that reason, because it's not flat walls. And he also was really into this sort of subtle lighting. The patent leather lounge had this really luminous lucite ceiling, and that also had this sort of, you know, kind of romantic lighting hidden within the ceiling. So he was really, you know, into like ceilings and lighting. And the iMagnon stores also had this kind of recessed lighting around these kind of scalloped ceilings, and then the light was kind of very delicate.
Can you think of any Art Deco architect of that kind of productivity or of that kind of stature anywhere in this country?
Well, Donald Deske in New York was, you know, who designed the Rainbow Room. He was pretty prolific. And there were a lot of architects in Miami Beach. Henry Hofhauser did a lot of those gorgeous hotels in Miami Beach.
But the range of the work.
Yes, Pfluger has a pretty eclectic range that, you know, starting out in Beaux-Arts and then kind of going, you know, Mission. And he really kind of covers a gamut of different styles.
Well, it's been fun having you here, and it's been fun learning about Timothy Pfluger, who's made quite a contribution to the city here in San Francisco. And the book, again, is Art Deco San Francisco, The Architecture of Timothy Pfluger by Therese Paoletti. She'll be at Mechanics Institute tomorrow at 6 p.m. and at the Art Deco Modernism Show on Saturday. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. If all goes according to plan, we'll be back with you tomorrow. We're going to talk in this hour tomorrow about Old Hickory, Andrew Jackson. John Meacham, editor of Newsweek, has done a biography of Andrew Jackson. Hope you'll join us for that. Thank you for joining us this morning. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.